from the Sky News Centre at 5. Iran is denying it tried to keep a nuclear facility secret, despite accusations from Barack Obama and Gordon Brown. It's admitted it's constructing a second uranium enrichment plant to create fuel for atomic power. But along with French and American leaders, the Prime Minister believes material could be used to make a bomb.
This is the third time that I believe they've been caught red-handed, not telling the truth about their nuclear intentions.
Four people have been jailed for their involvement in what the RSPCA has called one of the biggest cases of dogfighting it's ever prosecuted. They've been given sentences of between 4.5 and 6 months at Lincoln Magistrates Court. The gang, who were found to have paramilitary connections in Northern Ireland, supplied illegal pit bull dogs for fights as far away as Finland. Eight children are being treated in hospital after a car was in collision with a school party. A 40-year-old woman's been arrested on suspicion of dangerous driving following the incident outside a village church in Suffolk this afternoon. Ambulance crews say some of the casualties had critical injuries. A High Court challenge against compulsory retirement at 65 has been rejected. Age Concern and Help the Aged claim forcing someone to retire at 65 doesn't comply with EU rules on age discrimination. But Andrew Cave from the Federation of Small Businesses says scrapping the default retirement age would lead to confusion.
That ambiguity actually makes it more unlikely that employers or potential employers will look to employ older people.
A woman in the US has stunned doctors by falling pregnant while she was already expecting another baby. Doctors say Julia Grovenberg conceived 2.5 weeks after the first time. The wickets continue to fall in England's opening match at cricket's ICC Champions Trophy. A short time ago, the Sri Lankans were 197 for 8. That's the latest. I'm Alison McGarry.
This is Bristol Community 93.2 FM.
BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and in the studio this week is Labour councillor for Brislington East, Simon Crewe, as well as our regular old Labour political pundit and economics expert, Martin Summers. We'll be reviewing some of this week's news stories and talking to Simon about his work on the City Council. The Liberal Democrats are running the show now, but there will be no excuses for Simon tonight because it's been a Labour regime for most of the last 20 years. Also, this week we focus down on the postal dispute, which our postmen and women are voting on at the moment. Marina Morris has been out and about talking to you on the streets of Bristol to find out whether you know what the dispute is about and whether you think the Royal Mail should be privatised. Finally, a little snippet of news from Bristol City Council about the city's medieval freshwater supply, St John's Conduit, which has stopped working for the first time in 700 years. Yes, the City Council is responsible for looking after it, but no, they don't have any budget to fix it. On to discussing this week's news in a moment, but first, here's our two-week Friday Drive Time weather forecast from metcheck.com. This weekend is warm, 19 to 20 degrees Celsius, and sunny with definitely no rain. Did I hear myself just say definitely? Yes. Next week, continuing warm with sunny periods. Next weekend, that's the 3rd and 4th of October, is cooler with 13 to 15 degrees Celsius being the temperature. Cloud cover and rain. Well, Saturday, cloudy but rain-free. Sunday will be sunny all day, but it will be quite a breezy weekend, so quite cool. Week after next, temperatures around about 14 degrees Celsius. That was the long-range weather forecast for the next fortnight from metcheck.com. Well, on to our look through the week's news. And with us in the studio this week is Simon Crewe, who's Labour councillor for Brislington East. Welcome to Drive Time, Simon.
Thank you, Tony.
How long have you been a councillor now?
Since 2007, so 2 years and a bit.
And actually, as part of your work at the City Council, what committees are you on?
I'm on the Licensing Committee and Public Rights of Way and Greens Committee and the Fire Authority.
Okay. With the licensing, what sort of licensing do you do? I mean, what kinds of premises will be licensed these days by the City Council?
All alcohol licenses, late food after 11:30, I think it is at night. Certainly, there's also the taxes, but Bristol split that committee. The Public Safety and Protection Committee do the taxes, and the licensing stick with the other.
Because I remember, I think it was 18 months or 2 years ago, there was a whole mass of new legislation brought in to do with licensing, and it meant that the City Council Committee, I don't know if you were on it at the time, but was having to sit for great long periods of time to try and get all these licences sorted out. I mean, is that now straightened out?
Yes, that was before I was elected, but certainly the last licensing act meant every licence had to be renewed, and the officers did an awful lot of work to get it done on time.
So, if someone has got noisy things going on near their residence, then you're the person they need to talk to?
Well, usually they would go, maybe if as a local councillor I would, but not as a member of licensing committee. The licensing committee will hear the appeals, or if the police or the officers wanted to call in the licence.
So, but can the public do that, or is it just the police that can do it?
Yes, the public can as well, yeah, make representations.
So what should people do? Because this is one of those things that people aren't always sure of what they should do if they are being disturbed by some sort of licensed premises late in the evening, say, for example, early hours of a Friday morning or something.
You contact the licensing team on the City Council or their local police, and they'll be able to advise them where to go from there.
Okay, now, what about Labour on the City Council? Why did Labour get defeated by the Liberal Democrats in Bristol?
Well, there's a number of reasons. Certainly, the national situation couldn't have been worse with the in the last election. We're at a low, all-time low, certainly probably since universal suffrage, being a third party. So
are you saying this is basically nothing to do with the way Labour have been running Bristol? It's all to do with the central government. So really, you're kind of just dodging the blame, aren't you?
Oh, well, no, obviously there's lots of issues. People can vote on local issues in their wards. They could vote on citywide issues and national issues. I wish sometimes that local elections were about local issues, but no doubt the national situation has a huge effect on how people vote.
So don't you think that if someone is a particularly good councillor in their ward and are known by the people in that part of the city, then it's actually... people would ignore national politics and vote for them?
Yes, it can be done. I mean, certainly Ron Soane and Brenda Hugill this year held their seats, and that was due to the work they did locally. But then equally, some other very good councillors lost. So there's many reasons, yeah.
Okay, so what about you yourself? Are you from Bristol?
I am, yes, yeah. Lived in Brislington all my life, in my ward, yeah.
Okay, well, we'll be chatting to you again a little bit more later on in the programme as we discuss the news. Martin Summers is here too, our old Labour economics expert and pundit. Martin, you used to work for Amnesty International. What were you doing there?
It was very brief. It was just a short period of contract looking at their regional structure. But it was just it wasn't a long-term job. It was almost like being a consultant to them some years ago.
Okay, so anyway, let's start having a little look at some of this week's stories. We start with the Daily Telegraph straight away, who says the mole... This is a big story today. I don't know if you've got it on your little thing there, but this has been in the news today. The front page of the Daily Telegraph, we hear that the MP's expenses crisis mole, the person that leaked this information, is saying that that he leaked MP's expenses for the sake of the soldiers who had to buy their own kit. And he was disgusted to see that MPs were, he apparently says, is filching money from the public purse whilst soldiers are being impoverished. And he was apparently also was somebody who was actually employed processing MPs' receipts. Martin, do you want to start on this one? What are your thoughts about this revelation today?
Well, I think people need to get a sense of proportion about MPs' expenses. First of all, MPs were encouraged to claim everything that they were entitled to, and some have been, in my view, unfairly pilloried for claiming things which are absolutely legitimate under the existing system. And they were also given to understand that this would remain confidential and it's just between them and the people processing the claims. Those who have broken the existing rules are fair game. But I think people have got to recognise that politicians are if you added together all of the illegitimate expenses which have been bandied around, they don't add up to one banker's bonus. People have got a very, very distorted view of the way rewards are given in this society. Some people are allowed to take home millions, billions, and everybody just tugs their forelock and goes, oh, well, they deserve it.
But
politicians, they go, oh, no, there's all of this extra money. They're not allowed to claim expenses. I'm not saying that they should. I'm just saying, have a sense of proportion.
But the bankers are getting this money as part of their pay package, as part of their contract.
Yes, but also that we are that is actually public money as well. And we shouldn't, in fact, be encouraged. What should be happening with the banks now is that they should. A lot of the top managers should have been sacked without compensation, as would happen in any. If I was working for Bristol City Council as I did in the past, and I'd made a mess up like that, I would have been sacked
so
without compensation.
Are you saying that they should sack themselves, the bankers?
No, the government should sack them because they're the bosses. But the problem is they're not the bosses. The government, even the elected government of the country, is still in thrall to these people. They are able to say, you can't regulate. I mean, I was reading the head of the Bankers Association was speaking the other day and saying, well, we've got to stop knocking the bankers. It's bad for Britain. It's just ridiculous. I mean, they have made an awful mess of the global economy. Many people are going to die in many developing countries as a result of the mess they've made. It's absolutely unacceptable for them to carry on. And many, I mean, what you do, the way capitalism is supposed to work, the way public accountability is supposed to work, is that the people responsible for the mess ought to carry the can. They are not carrying the can.
So
that's
the
problem.
Are you saying the bankers have somehow hypnotised the politicians?
Well, I think what's happening is that people are concentrating on the politicians and failing to notice the elephant in the room.
So let's bring you in, Simon. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I'm very sceptical that the mole had very good intentions, because the Daily Telegraph aren't saying how much they paid him, and I'm sure that the monetary reward for leaking it must have been high in his mind at the time.
Well, what they're saying is that this wasn't the main reason that this was done. I think there's some dispute about how much the person was paid, whether they were paid, whether other people to do with the expenses scandal were paid.
This is very interesting, isn't it? Were they or were they not paid? If this is in the public interest, the people who've leaked this, then they shouldn't have been paid anything. And if they were paid, then one has to question what the motives are.
And whether that money actually went to support the soldiers, as we're being told that this is what.
Well,
the
I mean, that's I mean, the issue of whether the soldiers are being equipped or not is a separate issue. I mean, the problem is Brian Eno, the pop star, once said, is the problem is what he called prop agenda. Not propaganda, prop agenda. So what we do is we spend our time arguing about what the media thinks are the issues. Yeah. So we spend an awful lot of time on very trivial things, you know, what Posh Spice is wearing. But even the political issues are almost... an agenda is created. We really ought to be thinking about the economy, about the banks, about the fact that we could easily have another crash in the stock market once this stimulus package fails, as it may well do. People need to be thinking the big stuff, not squabbling about the small stuff. Sweating the small stuff is effectively what we end up doing. I'm not saying that MPs' expenses is not an issue. It is. But people still need to have perspective.
But Simon, as a politician yourself, you're bound to say that the person that leaked this information about the MPs is some sort of charlatan, aren't you?
No, I don't think I am. I think in many ways... Us as members of the public being able to see what MPs claim is a good thing. But if it's all about openness, why won't the Daily Telegraph say how much they paid them all?
Okay, well, one thing I did hear this morning on Radio 5 Live, our competition station, I should maybe mention them, but anyway, Major Lloyd Cummer, who also phoned in to Radio 5 Live earlier on from the Royal Regiment of Fusiliers in Nottingham, said that the kit that the soldiers have is top quality. Not really any need for soldiers to spend money on buying their own kit, except possibly the boots. Now, maybe, I don't know, this is what he's saying anyway, the idea that the soldiers needed any body armour, he says, is ridiculous. Anyway, let's move on to the G20 and the United Nations summit that's been going on over in the US. It's apparently been revealed that the Iranians have a second uranium enrichment plant. The Non-Proliferation Treaty does allow them to develop nuclear power, but not obviously nuclear weapons. Martin, what do you think about this? It seems that there's some activity in the nuclear world in Iran that's been going on, which they've been keeping from us.
Well, it's very hard to... I mean, obviously, propaganda, propaganda is very much in play here. I mean, what I think is extraordinary is that we had Gordon Brown, for example, saying that sanctions would be required if the Iranians didn't come to heel and so on, and nobody mentions the elephant in the room in this issue, which is the Israelis' possession of nuclear weapons and their refusal to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And again, our media did not really report that the UN General Assembly said that Israel should join the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and should allow inspectors into Dimona. Now, it was reported, but that's not the thing that's mainly reported. Now, if I was an Iranian military attaché, I would say, look, if the Israelis have got nuclear weapons, I would be going to my government, if democratic or otherwise, and saying, look, we've got to have nuclear weapons.
But the reason the Israelis, reason the Israelis are not signing this treaty is because they don't have confidence in it, because people like Iran, the countries like Iran, are getting round the treaty.
Well, I mean,
by not being honest about what
The obvious solution from the Iranian point of view is just withdraw from the treaty and then they can't be bullied. But that would be silly, wouldn't it? And in actual fact, they probably are just developing. There's no hard evidence that they're developing nuclear weapons at all. There is an awful lot of huff and puff going on, and also fabrication of documents, as we saw in the run-up to the Iraq war. Several of the documents which have been presented to the IAEA clearly are Secret Service fabrications from the West or from the Israelis. Now, when people present you with false documents, you stop taking everything they say seriously. And I think an awful lot of this is very dangerous saber-rattling.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, we were all told of the weapons of mass destructions in Iraq before the invasion of Iraq, and they're still yet to be found. So there's no doubt Iran have got a nuclear program, but whether they're developing the bomb is yet to be proven. And also, there needs to be a whole settlement in the Middle East. We cannot leave Israel out of it.
Well, I may be spitting in the church here, but I actually think it's quite feasible that the Iranians do have nuclear weapons. And I certainly remember in the mid-1990s...
I don't agree with this.
Well, that's fine. Yes, I know, Martin. I actually remember seeing a documentary back in the mid-1990s. It was on one afternoon, I think it was on an evening, and repeated the afternoon after on BBC Two, which was an investigative documentary, which appeared to show that ex-Russian... nuclear weapons from Ukraine were actually being... I mean, this is from a nuclear weapons storage facility in the Ukraine, which was virtually undefended whilst Russia was going and the Soviet Union was going through meltdown. And this documentary appeared to show that these nuclear weapons were actually then being sold on the black market to the Iranians. And I know that exchange of information and technology between the Russians and the former Soviet Union and Iran. So I don't think we can absolutely rule it out that it is possible that they do. Anyway, Simon, what do you think we should be doing about this? Never mind the rights and wrongs situation on the ground as it is at the moment. What should be going on at the UN at the moment, do you think?
I've heard some news stories saying that we're looking towards a non-nuclear world. Now, that may be a dream in many ways, but certainly we've got to be looking to abolishing the nuclear bombs. I think make sure those nations that have got them don't make any more to start off with, and so it doesn't spread to other nations.
Do you think that's a feasible possibility?
I think it's optimistic, but I think that we've got to be aiming towards that goal, because in the Cuban Missile Crisis, the world nearly came to an end. There was one Russian on a submarine which had lost contact. Who stopped them firing a missile? And it's just too dangerous for the future of the world to have loads of countries with the weapons.
Well, obviously, I agree with that, and I think the obvious place for us to start is save ourselves a few bob and scrap trident. Where people are talking now about cuts in public expenditure, well, this is another issue about whether we should cut public expenditure in a recession. But if we are going to have to balance the books or get closer to balancing the books, there's a lot of places to start rather than our schools, hospitals and education. It's got to be things like trident, they're white elephants. And, of course, then we would set an example to others. Of doing things the right way. What can we use it for? It costs us money. We're just giving it up.
But it's no good setting an example if it means that you can't defend the country properly, is it?
They're not much use to us in Afghanistan, are they?
Yeah, and there was argument of mutual self annihilation when there was the Soviet Union. But who are our weapons pointed against? The nuclear weapons. I've not been able to understand that over the Trident issue.
Okay, so next story is just staying with the conference over in the States. I think it shifted from being the United Nations General Assembly to seamlessly to the G20 meeting, didn't it? With lots of demonstrations apparently as well on the ground at the G20 particularly. So we have also Colonel Gaddafi over there, who was speaking for more than an hour at the General Assembly, and he was supposed to only do a 15-minute speech, Colonel Gaddafi of Libya. Of course, we've been covering Lockerbie quite a bit on this programme over previous weeks. What are your thoughts about Colonel Gaddafi's speech then? I mean, he's been talking for... He's supposed to speak for 15 minutes, but spoke for over an hour and a half in a wide-ranging, passionate address, which took in the UN Security Council, the assassination of US President John F. Kennedy, Somali piracy, and a theory that swine flu was created for military purposes. Now, has Gaddafi lost it, or Martin, or has he got a point?
Well, he sounds a lot like you, Tony. I think the point about Gaddafi is he's a bad guy, he's a good guy, he's a bad guy. It's extraordinary, isn't it? We know from the revelations by Annie Mashon and David Shaler that there were attempts to assassinate Gaddafi using the Libyan branch of Al-Qaeda.
Sorry, who are these people?
They're ex-MI5 officers. And, of course, their allegation about MI6 was that they were involved in trying to assassinate Gaddafi by financing the Libyan branch of Al-Qaeda, the Islamic Fighting Group. This was before 9/11.
This is David Shaler, the cross-dresser, who's now completely discredited himself.
He's obviously gone off in a rather strange direction, but his ex-girlfriend Annie Mashon is still quite sensible. But anyway, the point I'm making about the Libyans is that they are made into whipping boys, and then they become our allies. I mean, what's going on here? I mean, I think that there's an awful lot of manipulation of perception going on here. The Libyans are no real threat to Britain, and they never have been. But although, of course, they did, in fact, arm the IRA, so you could argue that they were a threat. But that was because we bombed them. And why did we bomb them? Because they planted a bomb in a discotheque in Berlin, which many people believe wasn't them that did that, that it possibly was the Israelis, etc. We can lose ourselves in a hall of mirrors here. But one thing is clear, we don't know who did Lockerbie, and most serious people don't believe it was the Libyans.
Yeah, Gaddafi is very entertaining. I didn't watch all of his speech, but the highlights looked entertaining. I don't know whether I'd want to have sat through it for that amount of time. Although he appears to play the clown, taking his tent to stay in as well in New York, he's a survivor. He's been there for 40 years. And it's interesting how he's managed to survive all the assassination attempts and the changes over the last 40 years.
So are you a fan of Gaddafi or not?
No, I won't say. Although he's entertaining, I think it's got to bear in mind how any opposition is treated in his own country.
Okay, Martin. But hang on, what's the problem about staying in a tent? This is a Bedouin, traditional Arabic tent. What's the problem there?
There's no problem with him staying in a tent. The problem, as Simon points out, is the repression of his own people inside Libya. And we ought to have a principled approach to these things rather than an unprincipled one, demonising him one minute and then calling him our best mate the next. There should be a steady pressure on people like Gaddafi to do the right thing, which should be consistent and which shouldn't be based upon geopolitical considerations.
Right, next story we're having a look at is Baroness Scotland, Lady Scotland. Her ex-housekeeper has been arrested by immigration officers, and the former housekeeper of the Attorney General arrested and questioned by immigration officers. Lolahai Tapoi, an illegal immigrant from Tonga, whose employment by Baroness Scotland prompted calls for the Attorney General to stand down, and she's been held by the UK Borders Agency officers in Chiswick. So, what about this, Simon? Do you want to start on this one? What are your thoughts about Baroness Scotland? Is she she's supposed to be the country's chief law officer, and she's been caught breaking the law?
Yeah, obviously it's very embarrassing for her and for the government.
I mean, she said at the time that it was a bit like maybe not paying the congestion charge. Do you go along with that?
I'm not sure how serious the law makes the offences, but certainly it's a matter for her to consider.
Well, you don't get fined £5,000 or up to £10,000 for missing a day of congestion charge paying, do you?
No, that's true.
And that's what she's had to pay so far for this particular offence. But as a matter of principle, do you think she should have resigned or not?
I'm not sure, really. I think that's a matter for the Prime Minister. So.
Or for her. Martin?
I think, you know, what we the wider issue is that all of the rules and regulations about this question of who's allowed to be here, who's allowed to work here and so on, have got to be transparent and transparently fair. And that's the only way to make everybody accept from all sides of the discussion that things are being done by the book. What I often say to people who say this, that all of these people are illegal who are coming in, many of them are working within the... I mean, all of the people that have just been removed from the place in Calais, from the jungle or whatever.
Yeah, we'll be talking about that in
We'll talk about that in a minute. But, I mean, I think you've got to have a fair and transparent system so that everybody can be confident. I mean, and economic migration is not allowed. Maybe it ought to be, because we're talking about globalisation where capital is absolutely free and we don't have any exchange controls. Maybe there should be free movement of labour. That's the kind of thing the economists argue. But, I mean, that's not the regulation at the moment. Most of the people who come here are seeking asylum because of persecution and problems in the countries where they come from. And I think it's very difficult for Britain to argue that, you know, when we're calling in airstrikes in Afghanistan, that that people haven't got the right to leave Afghanistan and we don't want to see them on our shores.
Now, Michael Heseltine on Question Time last night was arguing that these are not really asylum seekers. They're economic migrants. They're coming to Britain because they know that they stand a better chance of getting better pay and they can send money back to their families if necessary.
Well, I mean, what the immigration system is supposed to do is to sort out the economic migrants from those who are generally in fear of persecution. So that's what the system is supposed to do.
Yes, I agree. The system needs to be transparent so everybody knows where they stand. I mean, Barry Scotland was probably telling the truth when she said she didn't realise, and so if the government minister doesn't realise, then who does?
So do you think there's a sort of double standard going on here, a kind of schizophrenia, if you want, where there is a kind of acceptance of a lot of illegal economic migrants working because... obviously, I mean, it's better for business. You know, it's much cheaper to employ people like that. And so there's a kind of profit motive incentive to allow it to happen, even though the law says it shouldn't.
That's true. And also, of course, it means that when you have a downturn in the economy, you can get rid of people because they're not legal. And we know in the US that a lot of companies, particularly sort of in California, the agricultural production is deliberately designed to be carried out by illegals because they don't have to pay them properly. They can get rid of them if there's problems. That's why the system's got to be fair and transparent. And I'm ashamed if Lady Scotland has got to play by the rules like everybody else.
So what do you think? Do you think she should have resigned over this one?
Well, I, to be honest with you, it's a question.
If you were her,
if I felt that I was doing damage to the government by not resigning, then I would. I think she's got to consider it in that political light. Yeah.
Would you agree with that, Simon? Because you've been very shilly-shallying on this one.
Yes. Yeah. I think. Yeah. She's got to consider if this story drags on and on, and it is creating damage to the government. You'll have to. Yeah.
Well, it is dragging on and on, as it seems. There's more revelations coming out about this one all the time, and I'm sure there'll be more over the weekend. Anyway, next.
Meanwhile, the bankers are still paying themselves their bonuses, you know. We're talking about proper gender.
Right, razed to the ground, jungle migrants camp. This is the beginning of this week. It was emptied after a raid by the Calais police. And the Daily Mail says, but will it stop asylum seekers flooding into Britain? One thing that is pretty clear, though, from this article in the Daily Mail on the 22nd of September, is that the migrants, most of the migrants, are actually from Afghanistan and Iraq. Last Sunday, they sent out the defiant message, the only place we are going from here is Britain. Now, if, as it says, most of these people are from Afghanistan and Iraq, is that a coincidence that we just happen to be having wars in those countries? It doesn't seem to me, it seems to me at the face of it, that what Michael Heseltine is saying about this being purely economic is not the case, that maybe these people really are traumatised in their own country, and so they're trying to find somewhere decent to live.
Are you asking me? Well, yes. I mean, I think it's a bit rich for Britain to be complaining about these refugees scattered all over the world, since it's our policy which has plunged both Afghanistan and Iraq into chaos. When Saddam was in charge, people couldn't leave because he was in charge of it. And we decided to break all of that and create... I mean, the displacement within Iraq and into the local countries. Most people in Britain and Europe sometimes complain about immigration, but the real and refugees, but the real burden of refugees is often on neighbouring countries. Yeah, people from Somalia are arriving in Kenya. These are poor places where they really have got no resources. And I think as the global economic system seems to collapse and war seems to be spreading, we're going to see more and more of this. And what we've got to do is stabilise the economic system, stop starting wars, and then people will be quite happy to stay where they are. They're uprooted because we've created a global flotsam and jetsam system which we don't know how to control once we've started it. We need to stabilise developing countries, make a quality of life reasonable for people. There will always be some people who want to migrate for economic reasons. Many Britons migrated in the past. But again, it comes back to transparency and fairness, but also stabilising the world economy so that it isn't just run for the greedy few.
Yeah, no doubt it's not a coincidence that that's the two countries where there's terrible wars going on, which Britain has a guilty role in.
But what do we do about these camps? The other side of the channel, there may be more of these things springing up with people trying to get to the UK.
Yeah, I'd like to know really what when they say that they want to go to Britain, why is it? Has Britain got a reputation for being softer on asylum seekers, as it were, or do we treat them better? Because I don't see them.
I think there is evidence that Britain has a fairer and more transparent system than other parts of Europe. And also, we should be proud of the fact that people think that we are actually reasonable. People like coming here because they like us.
Well, I just want to cut in here, Martin, because apparently, according to this article, protesters, some in tears, shouted slogans at the police, including "Shame on France." Aid worker Sylvie Copians from the group Salam described the heavy-handed police response was disproportionate and sickening. To highlight this, she told how a frightened Afghan boy called Ali was torn from her arms by police as she wept. She said, "I tried to hide him. He was very, very frightened." Jessica Nora Shadia, 25, from Dunkirk, said, "It's shameful. They treat people like animals. Children were being pushed to the floor as if people have nothing. It's so sad. We tried to help them." She shrugged. What can you do? What can we do?
Tragic. Well, we're all in the European Union. Certainly, we got common borders and all sorts of common policies in Europe. There should be a Europe-wide policy on how we treat them, really.
Can I just mention that we had an Afghan asylum seeker in Bristol some years ago now, and he'd actually got a place to study engineering at Oxford University. And he just wanted to stay in the country long enough to complete his engineering degree. He was actually a Hazara Afghani. And he said, "And then I want to go back to Afghanistan to rebuild the country." But he wasn't allowed to stay and he wasn't allowed to take up his place. I mean, this is just silliness. We've got to remember that both Afghanistan and Iraq were part of the British Empire, as was Tonga, where the other lady came from. There's a reason why Britain is a magnet for all of these people. It's because it's called history. Our armies are marching to the other side of the world. Our goods go everywhere. Our banks control much of what goes on in the international financial system. And the other side of that is all of these international connections that Britain has. International connections which are at the root of our whatever prosperity we've got as well.
It sounds like you're living in the British Empire 60, 70 years ago.
No, I'm just saying that all historical background has consequences, and that's one of the consequences. And it's not as if the empire's over. We're still trying to impose our will in faraway lands, aren't we?
Okay, on to one of the, I think it's been one of the most fantastic stories of this week, the Anglo-Saxon gold hoard, which is the biggest ever and could get bigger. There's a great article in The Guardian today about this, which is, and it's interesting sometimes where the way that the Guardian does such a good job sometimes, and they've got Mike Pitts to write an article. Mike Pitts is the editor of the British Archaeology magazine, so rather than having sort of their ordinary journalists from the paper checking this out, you've got a real expert from the Archaeology magazine looking at it. He says, "Without question, this is the largest group of gold artefacts ever found in British soil, and there really is nothing like it, but it reminds me of a prehistoric find made near Salisbury in the 1980s. Here too, archaeologists were staggered by the sheer scale. There were more than 500 bronze items, including curious miniature shields, but that hoard was illegally excavated and sold, and we will never fully understand it. By contrast, thanks to Herbert's professional skills, skills and attitude, and this is a guy who's on benefits with a £25 metal detector, apparently, an attitude. We know everything we should and could about the Staffordshire Gold's context. That adds immediately to its academic value. So what are your thoughts on this, Simon? Do you want to start?
I think it's a fascinating story. I mean, this sort of time has been referred to as the Dark Ages. We know about the Romans and the later Saxons, but it's fascinating that there was a great society in this country at that time, which we know little about.
And this does seem that this is really, really, I mean, it's going to be probably months before the real historical importance of this is understood. But, I mean, I had to get hold of the papers this morning to have a look at some of these things. Martin, what do you think about this?
Obviously, it is fascinating. I've got a great interest in archaeology, so I'm particularly fascinated.
But this period in time in history, what really was going on in Britain?
Well, we know very little, which is why this is interesting. The comment I'd like to make in relation to this is the question about metal detecting, because the chap who'd found it was using a metal detector, and what was very important was that as soon as he'd identified what he'd found, he contacted professional archaeologists, and they were able to find all of this stuff in situ, whereas other metal objects which have been retrieved have been basically plundered, and that drives professional archaeologists mad, because as long as they know where it comes from, then they can find a lot more information. And there's been a bit of a war between metal detectorists and archaeologists over the last few years, but they seem to be coming to a modus vivendi, which is that, you know, the archaeologists are happy for people to metal detect, provided they work within guidelines, that they do actually report what they find without destroying the context, and that's very important. Otherwise, the most beautiful objects can be much less useful if you don't know what the context is.
So these were probably buried around about, what is it, 600 AD? Is that right?
Yeah.
Tell us about the Anglo-Saxons. Who were the Anglo-Saxons?
Well, I mean, they were invaders from Northern Europe at the end of the Roman Empire. Although what recent archaeological studies and DNA studies have suggested is that the actual population of Britain didn't change genetically dramatically. English became the dominant language, but many of us still have essentially pre-Anglo-Saxon genetics. So, I mean, these theories are constantly being refined by archaeologists. We've got a lot more knowledge now because of modern DNA analysis than we used to have about populations and how they change.
Sounds to me a little bit like the Roman invasion and the Norman invasion, where the only people that really seemed to change were the leaders.
That's usual. If you think of the Islamic conquests in the past, the whole society changes its outlook, but the actual people remain the same. They intermarry, and it's usually the case when conquerors conquer something, they want to take it over as a going concern. They don't actually want to work the land themselves, do they? They want somebody else to do that, and that's the locals.
But this is the 21st century. Does this really matter, you know, what was going on in 600 AD in a field in Staffordshire?
Yes, I think so. I think it's the history of this country, and it's interesting into our past.
Well, what it also underlines is we've always been a nation of immigrants.
Absolutely, yeah.
The Anglo-Saxons were not from round here in the first place either.
Okay, we're going to go on to have a look at the postal dispute now. That's the next story we're having a look at. And Marina Morris is with me, and she's put together a short special report on the postal dispute. That is between Royal Mail and the Communication Workers Union.
Yes, Tony. Next week, postal workers across Bristol will strike again. The strikes will begin on Sunday evening at 8 p.m. with distribution and collection drivers taking part in a 24-hour stoppage. On Tuesday, more than 400 workers at the distribution centre in Severn Beach will strike from 8 a.m. for 24 hours. The same day, about 1,000 workers at the giant sorting centre in Filton will strike. In the Bristol area, there is already a backlog of just under a million items of mail to be delivered because of recent strike. Across the country, the backlog has sorted to 10 of millions of items, which union bosses say is bigger than at the height of the national strike held 2 years ago. The London area is worst affected. A national ballot of 130,000 members of the Communication Workers Union has begun on whether to make strike action national. Both parties agree that change is necessary. The Communication Workers Union says that they have offered a 3-month no-strike deal in return for negotiation and a suspension of the current change, which are forcing postal workers into industrial action. The union wants to share the benefits of greater efficiency, these sustainable full-time jobs, no compulsory redundancies, enhanced terms and conditions, higher pay for a shorter working week, and a better local working environment. Royal Mail Managing Director Mark Hackson said the CWU leadership is well aware of what has already agreed all the change Royal Mail is making, and we urge them to recognize the tough economic condition faced by all our customers and Royal Mail itself, and to live up to their claims to support modernization and to focus, as the company is doing, on delivering the postal service on which so many customers depend. Management says that mail volumes are down by around 10% year-on-year as the competition from emails and the web accelerates, which every 1% decline costing Royal Mail around £70 million in lost revenues. Mail volumes are also declining in every major market around the world. The changes Royal Mail is making have already been successfully made by our people in most part of the UK, and quote example of inefficient working practices. The two sides appear to be far apart and the postal service in trouble. The result of the strike ballot will be known early next month. Here is what the people of Bristol think about postal strike.
Do you know why the post office workers are going to strike, and do you support them?
Because the workforce are unhappy with the modernisation processes taking place. Modernisation is a must for any industry at the moment, isn't it? And economies and all those sorts of things, we're all under the same pressures pretty much. In my employers have cut workforce, cut processes, or reinvigorated processes, and all those sorts of things. And it's pretty much the same everywhere. You know, not even nationwide, worldwide. So, not massively, to be perfectly honest,
because they're not paid enough. Just like a lot of people in this country, they're not paid enough, and there's a history of people going on strike in this country, and we like to have a moan when we get the chance. I think that's about it, really. I'm not sure whether I support them or not, actually. I don't really have an opinion on it. That's my opinion, really. You just have to live with it.
Not really, but I guess it's all about more money, as usual. Well, in these times of economic changes, I think they choose their times quite badly. So when that, I suppose they do, but I wouldn't have chosen now to pick a fight.
No, I presume it's about money. That's all I know. I'm not sure, actually, because I don't know enough about exactly what's happening.
Do I know why the folks probably? Because they think they're not paid enough, I presume. Either they just think they're not paid enough, or is this to do with proposed post office closures? You tell me.
No, I don't really. No, I don't know much about it. I've not read much about it, no. Well, if I don't really know the reasons, I can't really give an opinion. So that's all I can say on it, really.
Do you think the strike will affect you?
In terms of business correspondence not coming through, obviously it's affecting my whole country. Not only business, but personal correspondence as well. So yeah, it might have an effect.
It means that I will probably use things like Parcelforce and private companies more to post things because they're more reliable. So a double-edged sword, I guess. They strike because they want more money, but it means less people use the service.
No, I wouldn't have thought it would affect me that much. It may help me. I might get my bills late.
Okay. I don't think it'll affect where I live very much. No, I don't think it'll affect me, if I'm honest.
Well, it'll be extremely difficult. I can't send any mail.
Not too much, because I don't generally use post offices that often.
Personally, not too much, because I don't use the post office a great deal. Apart from to buy stamps, I don't really have too much dealings with the post office.
Do you think that the Royal Mail should be privatised?
Should be privatised? On balance, probably not.
No, probably not. Because it's a system that we all rely on. No, I don't think so. No, I think it should be state-run. Because when it's been privatised, or since it's been privatised, the service has become more unreliable. Whereas when it was a state-run, it was more reliable. Much like a lot of industries in the country, the trains being another good example. Privatisation hasn't really done any of those industries many favours, I don't think.
Well, the only thing I'd say on that is that most things that they've already privatised seem to be not doing very well, so why continue with a policy which is clearly not working elsewhere? So, in that I'd say no, leave it, Royal Mail, we own it.
Oh, the Royal Mail? No, I don't think it should be privatised, because I think it's a bad thing when things become privatised. They often don't work. I think it's better to stay as it is at the moment.
I don't know, really. It's I suppose if it should have more competition, I suppose, because then there's more competition, there will be more possibility of prices being perhaps brought down, or service could be better if there's more competition. But at the moment, Royal Mail has it all to itself. So, could be better, or then again, it's not. I can't give a certain answer on that, but it could be better if it were.
Now, it's certainly clear from what people are saying out there that most people don't know what this dispute is about. So I spoke earlier today to the Communications Workers Union, who represent postal workers.
My name's David Wilshire. I'm the branch secretary of the Communication Workers Union in Bristol and District, representing around about 3,500 postal workers. What's at the centre of our current dispute with Royal Mail is that they've taken the decision at board level to withdraw from the agreement we signed with them in 2007, which was called the Pay and Modernisation Agreement. That agreement gave a number of commitments to further talks on modernisation, the introduction of new technology, a new reward framework for their employees, our members, based on higher basic pay. And they've reneged on that agreement. They're ploughing ahead with modernisation, what they call modernisation, in individual units. The reality is that it's just about cutting hours. We don't believe there's anything modern in that at all. And as a result of that, our members' terms and conditions are suffering, as well as the service to the public.
But surely the idea of striking is just balmy, because the people who are going to benefit from that are all these private companies that are sort of circling around the post office and taking away some of the business. So that they will be laughing at the idea that you are going on strike, because they will be actually doing really well out of this.
Well, in relation to the private companies, I mean, the postal market's been opened up to competition, and there's something called downstream access, which means that private companies that are bulk posting mail actually use all of Royal Mail's facilities, but at a fraction of the cost that the normal customer's got to pay. So when we're on strike, the facts of the matter are that people using basically the Royal Mail process and Royal Mail equipment and Royal Mail processing centres to get their mail through for delivery, that will be affected as well. So, I mean, it is a strike about saving the postal service, protecting our members' terms and conditions, and it's a strike, really, that is also going to hit the competitors hard, and that is why Royal Mail really should start talking seriously about resolving it.
Can you just give us an example of how these changes that the Royal Mail are bringing in at the moment will affect, say, you know, the average postman or woman that delivers our mail to our doors? Can you just give us a specific example of, you know, something that's happened to a particular postman or woman?
Yeah, I mean, what's likely to happen is that duty patterns, start times and finish times are going to be retarded, move backwards, so that people are going to be starting work, people on delivery around about 10 o'clock in the morning, finishing 6 in the evening, which obviously means the mail is going to get there a lot later to the customer. But what that also means is that there's far less opportunities to perform overtime. So our members are seeing their earnings levels dramatically reduced as a result of that. And of course, there's been a pay freeze announced by the Royal Mail Board, despite the fact that they made £321 million profit last year, and that the chief executive is earning 157 times that of the average postal worker.
Don't you think that this is partly motivated by bitterness, you know, that the ordinary post people around the country aren't being paid as much as some of the chief executives? But, I mean, that's just part of modernisation and part of the way that things have just got to be.
Well, we don't believe that when you've got a chief executive that who's in a position where the wages for the chief executive have increased by 1,222% since 1989. All that postal workers are asking for is basically a share in the success of the company. The company is successful at the moment. The company is making a profit, and quite rightly, postal workers in Bristol and elsewhere expect a share of that profit, and we don't believe that there's anything wrong with that. Royal Mail is a company that is bucking the recession, bucking the trend.
Simon, that was Dave Wilshire, by the way, there's from the Communication Workers Union in the South West. Simon, if you were a postal worker at the moment, would you be voting to strike or not?
I think I would, Tony. It seems that the union are willing to negotiate, but the management are totally ignoring them. I mean, they're saying they're in favour of some modernisation. It needs to be happened. They recognise that.
But who's running the post office? The management or the postal workers?
Well, obviously the management, but they must negotiate with the workers. It seems to me that they're just trying to slash their conditions. I've heard some places they're just taking on part-time workers. So I think it's a very concerning situation. I can remember back in the early 90s marching around the streets of Bristol against post office privatisation, and we won that battle. So I was very concerned when Lord Mandelson came back and was suggesting that, and I'm glad that's been put on the back burner, that policy, for a while. But I'd always oppose that, and I'd hope the management can come and negotiate a good future for the Royal Mail with the workers.
But do you think it's important that the postal workers actually carry the public with them? Because at the moment it seems that, particularly from our Vox Pop, a lot of people are saying this is a bad time to pick a fight.
Yes, and I think I'm glad this was mentioned today, because most people don't know what the dispute is about. As we heard there, I think most people were saying it must be about pay. So,
it partly is about pay, yeah, clearly, yeah. Because overtime is being cut.
Yeah, but it's mainly about the conditions and if the future of the Royal Mail.
Yeah, do you think that this, as one of the things I suggested to Dave there, that this is actually handing part of the fight to the private competition that already exists, because these people will now be gearing up to being the postal service during the strike?
Yes, that is a danger, and that's why I hope the management can come to accommodations, at least to agree to negotiate with the unions quite soon.
Do you think there's any real prospect of that?
I hope so. I hope that they'll be able to see sense and negotiate, because they'll be losing the business as further it goes on.
But if you had to bet one way or the other,
I'm optimistic. I hope they will eventually. But it will be interesting how strongly that the strike is supported by the staff. If there is a huge support from the staff for the strike, I think they'll have to come to the table.
Martin?
Well, obviously, I agree with most of that. I think what we really need is some kind of strategic idea of what we want the post office to be. You can see there's a genuine affection for the Royal Mail amongst the public. This is why these privatisation proposals are not very popular. Many parts of the country, people are unhappy about the closure of post offices because of the vital role they play in bringing the community together and providing specifically elderly people with links to the outside world. This whole ideology of privatisation, increasing the pay of the managerial classes, this is really actually over. We're still going through we're still talking about this in this kind of way, and we've just got to get. We're going to have some kind of overall conception of what we want the British economy to be doing, which we used to have, and then we gave it all away and decided that the market was going to decide it all. Yeah. Because you can't. What's happened is cherry picking of the services. All of the things that make money have been allowed open to competition. All of the functions that the Royal Mail performs, which are less profitable but socially necessary, have been dumped back on the Royal Mail. Now, in the old days, you could cross subsidise. Yeah, so you could send letters to the Orkney Islands by cross subsidising the business mail. And you conceive of the thing as an overall system. Competition doesn't always work. You don't always get lowered prices and increased service. Often because competition isn't feasible because of the way the industry is structured.
But we've had
industries are natural monopolies.
We've had it too good for too long, haven't we? We've been paying a fraction of what it costs to send letters. Say, for example, as you said there, to the Orkney Islands.
Well, I mean, that's because we want to keep the Royal Mail was one of the first nationalised industries and was created as a nationalised industry because it's a very, very important integrative function. Yeah? That everybody can get a letter posted from one end of the country to another was considered to be it's providing a service. It's not about profit. It's about providing a service, and I think we've lost sight of that. And good conditions for the workers are important, and also just negotiation. I mean, what is the matter? I mean, they've got a deal which they've agreed, and the management are reneging on what's already been agreed. Now, if you don't strike against that, you might as well not be in a union at all.
Well, I think what the management are saying is that the conditions have changed from this deal a couple of years ago. Now conditions are different.
As we heard some of the Vox Pops people saying, "Oh well, in this kind of conditions, we shouldn't be striking or whatever." It's we've got to perceive the economic crisis isn't caused by post people. It's been caused by the City of London and Wall Street. And again, we're talking about proper gender here. Yeah? One of the things that people always say is when you want rich people to work harder, you pay them more because otherwise they might leave the country and take their talents away. When you want poor people to work harder, you pay them less. Now, this is part of our culture. And it's part of the way, particularly the privileged classes think, but it's just wrong.
Yeah, I certainly feel the postal service should be first and foremost a public service, run as a public service. And take it in America, for instance, the home of capitalism, as it were, the U.S. Postal Service is run as a nationalised industry, so part of the government. So I think it's crazy if we're thinking of privatising it.
Okay, Simon. Well, that's pretty much all the news we're looking at this week. But before we go, I'd like to give you a little chance to tell us what, if you could change anything, just one thing at Bristol City Council, as a councillor that's been there for a couple of years, relatively fresh to the wonderful world of Bristol City Council democracy, what would you change?
Yeah. I've changed the cabinet system, really. I mean, I've been involved in the Labour Party quite a while when they had the old committee system. And sometimes I wonder, as a backbench councillor, there's all the decisions are made by the group of eight. What were the rest of us there for when we go down the council house? So we've got lots to do in our wards, but I'd like to put back the committee system so we're all on the committees and we've got a chance to have our say on each big decision.
So what's the difference between a councillor that's on one of these big in the cabinet and a, as you say, backbench councillor like yourself?
Basically, as I see it, the full council itself, all where 70 of us are sat in a chamber shouting at each other every 6 weeks, has only got two functions: to elect the leader and to set the budget. For the rest of the major things would go to council, but legally then every decision in the council structure is made by the cabinet of eight.
And so what does that mean effectively? Do you think that the people that are voting for you aren't really getting what they should be after that, after you've won an election?
Well, I think being elected members should have more say on things. So certainly we all go down there and have our say, and if we feel strongly about any cabinet decisions, we can say it full council or make representations to the cabinet. But I think I think there should be more involvement in the decision making.
Well, that's all for this week. Coming up next, the Sky News at 6 o'clock. Do please join us at 5 on Friday Drive Time each week here on BCFM 93.2, where we review the week's news and discuss some of the big stories in Bristol, Britain and around the world. If you want a story discussed, have questions about this evening's programme, or would like to suggest a topic or guest for a future show, please email me at tony@bcfm.org.uk. Thanks very much to this week's guest, Simon Crew, who's Labour councillor for Brislington East, and our resident old Labour pundit and Oxford economist, Martin Summers. The Royal Mail dispute report and Vox Pop was courtesy of Marina Morris. Next week, a special report on one of the most pioneering festivals in our part of the world, the Big Green Gathering. Like Ashton Court Festival, it too has gone bankrupt, but this time in more murky circumstances, after being threatened with an injunction by Mendip District Council. We find out what really happened. If you're on the internet, you can hear previous week's shows and find out what's scheduled for forthcoming weeks by going to bcfm.org.uk and clicking on Presenters Shows on the right-hand side to find the Friday Drive Time page. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend.